It was 100 years ago that the carnage of World War I finally stopped, but Australians had been holding silent remembrance services well before the war ended, with the first Anzac Day commemoration in 1916. And the first attempt to commercialise Anzac was made even earlier. Jo Hawkins has been studying how Anzac became what she calls Australia's most powerful brand in her book, Consuming Anzac. Jo Hawkins, welcome to the world today.
Thank you.
Just how early did the commercial interest in the Anzacs begin?
Oh, very early indeed. It was only months after the landing, and certainly though the commercialisation of the word Anzac really starts to build up steam after the evacuation at the end of 1915. But it was astonishing the power of that word, which had only just been invented. But you see back home in Australia, especially in 1916, Anzac tea, Anzac beer, Anzac soap. I found that absolutely remarkable. But I think the thing that I also found even more remarkable was how quickly the federal government acted to stamp this out.
Yes, what was the reaction back then from the government and the return services organisations to this attempt to turn Anzac into a brand?
Yeah, they were horrified. It's so interesting to me because this is really early 20th century. We've got this really dynamic consumer culture. But they didn't really know exactly how it would hinder the sacred meanings associated with the word, but they had a good idea that it would be a big risk. So there was instances, very sad instances, where there was an example of a cafe owner, and her son had actually helped her build the cafe, and he'd gone to Gallipoli and he died over there, and she wanted to name it the Anzac Cafe in his memory, and she got a very stern no from that. Also, I find it so fascinating, the veterans themselves, they wanted to come back and they wanted to distinguish themselves from people who might not have served and earn a living. There was a chap who made an Anzac toy manufactory, this toy business, and he used to be a plumber, but he couldn't work as a plumber anymore, and the poor chap didn't understand why he couldn't use the word Anzac when he was selling his toys, and he explained to the Governor General, "But I stormed the beaches. I was there. I made this name Anzac. I made this word. Why can't I use it?" But again, I think very soon the word belongs to the nation and becomes controlled by people that weren't veterans and weren't the bereaved. It becomes controlled by state authorities and then veterans organisations. And really that idea about commemoration and commerce being two separate things, really that attitude kept up right up until really the 1980s.
Anzac Day lost its appeal in later decades, and especially after the Vietnam War, there was a sense that the Anzac tradition could have quietly died out. But there was a resurgence in interest in Anzac Day from the 1980s. Why?
There was indeed. Well, there was a resurgence in interest in war memory all over the Western world. They call it the memory boom. And it's lots of different factors involved in this, including, you know, post-war education and you know, more affluence in society as well. I think to consume memory, you need time, leisure time, and you need money. And both of those elements became freer in the 60s, 70s, and then, of course, the 80s. Then I think there's also this sense that the generation that experienced that the war, both World War I and World War II, were getting older, and they started to be more willing to discuss what happened, as well, of course, as several really big commemorative anniversaries that governments all over the world got behind.
How did the return service organisations and the government change their tack on the commercialisation of Anzac during this time?
Well, this is just, I found, absolutely fascinating. So really, they did a complete backflip, and I think there was a surge in demand and interest in war memory, and yet, of course, at the same time, we were losing that real-life connection with that event. And where there was an opportunity, the marketplace came to manufacture a replacement. And I think there was recognition there that this demand needed to be sated, and that in order to do this, consumer culture could play a role. And because there was a complete backflip, and I think since, in particular, the 1990s, veterans organisations and the federal government have very happily sanctioned a number of quite significant commercial relationships and arrangements.
The then Prime Minister John Howard noted at the state funeral of the last Gallipoli soldier, Alec Campbell, that the attention he drew was, quote, unsought and in many ways unwelcome. To what extent do you think were the wishes of Anzac veterans themselves taken into account in the government and commercial uses of the Anzac mythology?
I've been thinking about that a lot over the last week, especially. Certainly, it feels like the voices, because I spend most of my time with the veterans of the first two wars, and especially the veterans of the Great Wars. I read their diaries, I look at newspaper articles, and that generation would have been horrified by some of the commercial tie-ins today. In particular, I'm thinking about the way in which arms manufacturers are sponsoring a lot of the Australian War Memorial now. And so I think there is a really interesting tension. It's a tension between that. But I feel like even now we're not talking to veterans. We just had an example just last week with Virgin Australia offering priority entry and a shout out to veterans on flights, and they immediately responded, no, nobody asked us, we don't want this.
And how do you think commercial factors and political interests have changed the Anzac myth?
Well, that is something that I was thinking about the entire time I was researching this book, because of course there's a number of, I guess, approaches to how history is made, you know, often, and especially war history. So some people will say, oh, you know, it's influenced heavily by the state authorities and political elites. And others will say, well, no, you know, communities have amazing, you know, huge agency, and individuals have this psychic and spiritual connection with this tradition. And both of those are actually true. So the answer is somewhere in the middle. But, I think it's such an interesting question. Who influences history? And that was the core really reason I wrote the book, because I thought, well, actually, the marketplace has logics of its own. It's got an entire, there's mutually beneficial relationships that are driving the production of memory, and we're not really looking at it. And what stories are told and what stories remain untold. And what I found really was that corporations that are involved in this kind of activity, yes, you know, it's part of, they see it as part of their social responsibility, but their number one priority is answering to their shareholders, ensuring that their profits are looking good. They're not concerned with historical understanding or good history. And I think that's something that we need to be just in very, very mindful of, because these commercial arrangements and the involvement of corporations in remembrance is only growing.
That's author Jo Hawkins, and her book is called Consuming Anzac.